Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I am Chris Anderson.
And I'm Lee Bradley. It's great to be here digging into these sources with you.
Today, we are taking on a comprehensive and exhaustive deep dive into the Associated Press early edition for Sunday, November 23rd, 2025.
And our mission, as always, is pretty clear.
It is. If you need that thorough, detailed view of everything that matters, you know, from the big tectonic shifts in global politics to some of the most surprising cultural and scientific developments, we are going to cut through all the noise for you.
That's right. We aren't just summarizing the headlines here. We are going to absorb the most important, the most complex, and honestly, sometimes the most bewildering stories.
And really extract the true implications that are hiding just beneath the surface.
Exactly. We'll be connecting the dots between, well, geopolitical flashpoints, some massive crises of scientific integrity, and even the simple science of how fast you should be eating your dinner.
It is a phenomenal stack of sources we have today. So let's get right into the global arena. Starting with a really confusing and diplomatically fraught situation, it's about the war in Ukraine and the Trump administration's involvement in a supposed peace plan.
This story is, it's less about peace and a lot more about a huge diplomatic embarrassment.
It seems that way.
Yeah. So for weeks, the administration had been, you know, quietly involved in drafting this, this 28-point plan, a document that was supposedly blessed by the U.S.
And this was the work of National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, right, along with a special envoy.
Steve Witkoff, yeah, that's right. So they're all involved.
And this plan gets widely leaked, but the moment it hits the international stage.
Right, the administration just completely throws it under the bus.
Exactly. So what happened at the Halifax International Security Forum?
That forum, it became the stage for a really dramatic disavowal. You had these key bipartisan senators showing up.
Mike Rounds, Angus King.
Tom Tillis, all of them. And they hold this impromptu press conference specifically to address the confusion that this leaked document was causing.
Okay, and at first they tried to downplay it.
Well, Republican Senator Rounds, he initially tried to frame it as, you know, just a starting point, a conversation starter.
But that's not where the story ended.
Not at all. The real revelation came from Senator Angus King.
And the message she relayed was coming directly from Secretary Rubio.
Directly. Senator King tells the public that Rubio had communicated to them in no uncertain terms that the leaked 28-point document, quote, was not the administration's plan.
Okay, so if it's not their plan, whose is it?
Well, this is the kicker. It was, in King's words, a wish list of the Russians.
Russian wish list.
Yes. And that's where this story shifts from just, you know, simple confusion to a genuine crisis of credibility.
A Russian wish list that critically includes granting Moscow large pieces of occupied Ukrainian territory.
Uh-huh.
These are territorial concessions that Ukrainian President Zelensky has just categorically rejected from day one. So why would an official U.S.-backed process ever let a document so closely aligned with Russian demands get released and, even for a moment, be attributed to them?
That is the core question, isn't it?
Okay.
It's all about U.S. diplomatic credibility now. The senator's consensus was, well, it was damning.
What did they say?
They said this plan rewards Moscow for its aggression. And if the U.S. were to actually back it, it would set a profoundly dangerous global precedent.
So it's not just about Ukraine.
No, it's about the global message. Senator King was unambiguous. He said the proposal rewards aggression. There's no ethical, legal, moral, political justification for Russia claiming eastern Ukraine.
It's a signal to every other regional power.
Exactly. It tells them that, you know, territorial conquest, if you can just sustain it long enough, can eventually be codified in a peace settlement. A terrible, terrible message.
And we have to talk about the context of the location here. The Halifax Forum. This is an event the Trump administration was deliberately snubbing.
They were. They suspended participation for U.S. defense officials because of ongoing strained relations with Canada. So you have the situation where U.S. senators are scrambling to clean up a diplomatic mess and reassure allies.
While the administration itself had officially just checked out of the whole security discussion.
It's an incredible look.
Yeah.
And the timing couldn't be worse.
Oh.
Putin, late on Friday, he welcomed the proposal. He said it could form the basis of a final peace settlement if the U.S. could just convince Ukraine and its European allies.
So Moscow gets a huge propaganda win.
A significant one, yeah. They get to align themselves with a peace effort that, you know, moments later gets dismissed by key U.S. figures as being their own demands.
And how did Zelensky react to all this?
Well, he handled it very delicately. He promised to work calmly with Washington during what he called truly one of the most difficult moments in our history.
So he's not burning bridges?
No, not at all. He didn't reject the idea of peace, but he insisted on fair treatment. He's walking this very fine tightrope between, you know, diplomatic necessity and national sovereignty.
Wow. Okay, so from one political tremor in Eastern Europe, let's go to a seismic political event in South America.
Right.
The preventative arrest of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. And this isn't just about his prior conviction, is it? It's about what he did while under house arrest.
That's exactly right. Bolsonaro, he's what, 70 now?
70, yeah.
And he'd already been convicted, sentenced to 27 years in prison back in September for leading a coup attempt.
So he was under house arrest, deemed a flight risk, and he had to wear an ankle monitor.
He did. And the immediate trigger for this preventative arrest on Saturday was his own alleged attempt to, well, to defeat that monitoring device.
You said alleged, but the evidence cited seems pretty striking.
It is. The custody agents, they filed a report. And in it, they state, Bolsonaro admitted to using a soldering iron to try to open the device.
A soldering iron?
Yeah. And the court footage apparently shows the cap of the monitor was heavily damaged.
So the judge overseeing the case, Demarest?
Justice Demarest, yes. He cited this attempted tampering as the critical evidence. He said it confirmed that Bolsonaro posed an immediate and genuine flight risk.
And Demarest didn't just see this as some random act of desperation, did he? He connected it to something else.
He did. He specifically connected it to a large protest that was organized by Bolsonaro's son, Flavio, which was scheduled for later that same day.
So he thought the protest was a diversion.
Demarest's reasoning was very strategic, very specific. He believed the big political protest was intended to act as a distraction.
A cover.
A cover under which Bolsonaro could escape. The justices even noted a potential destination.
Where?
The U.S. Embassy in Brasilia, which, by the way, was a mere 15-minute drive from Bolsonaro's home.
That U.S. connection is fascinating. Demarest has a history of political conflict with the Trump administration. And didn't we have reports earlier this year about Bolsonaro looking for political asylum in Argentina?
We did. So given the political history and those documented asylum inquiries, a flight to the U.S. Embassy seems like a genuine possibility.
It would create huge diplomatic complications.
Immense. Though President Trump was very cagey, I guess, when he was asked about the arrest. He just said, is that what happened? That's too bad.
And then mentioned he'd spoken to the current Brazilian president.
Lula, yes, the night before. Mm. So this whole event, it forces Washington into a very delicate position about asylum requests from a convicted former head of state.
And the domestic political implications for Brazil's right wing are just huge, aren't they? Especially looking ahead to the 2026 presidential election.
They are absolutely defining. I mean, look, Bolsonaro is barred from running until 2030.
But he's still the central figure.
He is the central organizing force of the Brazilian right. A political analyst told the AP that Demarest's preemptive arrest essentially forces Bolsonaro's team to immediately execute a really high-stakes strategy.
What's that strategy?
It's twofold.
Yeah.
First, they have to urgently identify and unify behind an alternative successor, someone who can carry that political mantle.
And second?
Second, they have to frame Bolsonaro not as a criminal, but as a martyr and an impactful popular leader ahead of the 2026 campaign.
And his allies are already doing that.
Oh, immediately. They're calling the justice psychopathic and the arrest a terrible stain. So this preventative arrest, it just significantly accelerates the political timeline for the entire opposition.
Okay, let's move now to the Middle East. We have some very grim reports showing just how fragile that October 10th Gaza ceasefire is.
It's being severely tested.
By deadly Israeli strikes over the weekend.
The reports are deeply alarming. Hospitals confirmed 24 deaths just from Israeli strikes on Saturday alone, and many of the victims were reported as women and children.
This just underscores the instability of the agreement.
Profoundly. Residents are describing the situation on the ground as a fragile ceasefire, with this pervasive feeling that no location is truly safe.
Can you give us some specifics on one of these deadly incidents?
We have a specific report about a strike on a vehicle in Gaza City's Rimal neighborhood. It killed 11 people and wounded 20.
And the hospital director there?
The managing director of Shifa Hospital, yes. He confirmed that the overwhelming majority of the wounded were children.
And this incident really exemplifies the challenge, doesn't it? Distinguishing between military targets and humanitarian spaces in such a densely populated area.
It's the core challenge. And the justifications for these strikes are, as you'd expect, completely contradictory between the two sides.
So what's Israel's claim?
Israel's military claimed they were acting against Hamas militants after an armed terrorist entered an Israeli-held area in southern Gaza and fired at troops.
And there's a crucial detail there about a humanitarian road.
There is. Israel claimed this person used a road that had been specifically designated for humanitarian aid access. They framed this as an extreme violation of the ceasefire by Hamas.
And Hamas's response?
Conversely, Hamas's political bureau stated that Israel was, quote, fabricating pretext to evade the agreement and return to the war of extermination.
So they're calling on international mediators.
Yes, urging them, like the U.S., to compel Israel to abide by the truce. It's a classic information war being waged right alongside the physical one.
And the stakes are just staggering, the humanitarian toll.
They are. Gaza's health ministry and their casualty figures are widely used for context by independent bodies. They state that 69,733 Palestinians have been killed.
And over 170,000 injured.
Since the war began in October 2023. And these numbers just keep rising, not just from new strikes, but from the ongoing recovery of bodies from the rubble.
It just shows the extent of the catastrophe that this ceasefire is struggling to contain.
Right. The whole situation remains incredibly volatile. That agreement is hanging by a thread with every single casualty report.
That provides some devastating context for these global flashpoints. Let's shift our focus back now to domestic, political, and judicial battlegrounds.
Okay.
And we can start with a very specific and controversial political targeting by President Trump in Minnesota.
This involves an incredibly targeted and, I'd say, inflammatory pledge made on Truth Social.
What was the pledge?
President Trump announced he would immediately terminate temporary protected status, or TPS, for Somali residents in Minnesota.
And he didn't just leave it at that.
No. He framed the move with these unsubstantiated claims, alleging Somali gangs were targeting residents and that the state was a hub of fraudulent money laundering activity.
I'm immediately fascinated by the legal tightrope he's walking here. Experts were quick to say the president cannot legally terminate TPS for a specific state or community that he has beef with, as one policy director put it.
Right. And that gets to the legal intricacies of the TPS designation.
So what are they?
Temporary protected status, it's a designation granted by the Department of Homeland Security, DHS. It's for nationals of specific countries who just can't safely return because of war, environmental disaster, other extraordinary conditions.
And it's a national designation.
It's a national designation. The president cannot legally just pick and choose to terminate it based on state or city boundaries. It doesn't work that way.
And the number of people actually affected by this?
It's tiny. A congressional report in August cited only 705 individuals nationwide covered by TPS from Somalia.
So the vast majority of the Somali community in Minnesota are already U.S. citizens.
The vast majority, yes. Naturalized citizens.
So if the actual policy impact is basically negligible, the intent here has to be purely rhetorical and political.
Oh, absolutely. It's a classic example of political rhetoric designed to energize a specific base and, you know, generate media outrage. It far outweighs the operational reality.
And he's linking an existing legal status, TPS, to these highly charged negative claims.
Unsubstantiated claims, yes, of criminality in Somali gangs. He's clearly employing Islamophobic rhetoric to rally support among anti-immigrant and nationalist voters.
So does the legal mechanism even exist to revoke this status?
Well, it does exist to revoke TPS for Somalis nationally. The administration has until mid-January to do that. But the specificity of the attack on Minnesota suggests the goal here is purely psychological and political.
And Minnesota state leaders, Governor Tim Walz, Attorney General Keith Ellison, they're pushing back hard.
And not just on principle, but on the basis of fact.
Right.
They quickly condemned the move, pointing out that Minnesota consistently ranks among the safest states in the country, which directly contradicts Trump's claims of rampant gang activity.
What did Ellison say?
AG Ellison stated his office was exploring all of our options, and he emphasized the legal absurdity of it all. He said Trump cannot terminate TPS for just one state or on a bigoted whim.
So this is seen as a direct political attack.
One that could severely inflame hate and risk the safety of a vibrant community that is, again, mostly composed of U.S. citizens.
Okay, now let's pivot to what is perhaps the most critical story this week regarding institutional integrity.
I agree.
The crisis at the CDC involving the integrity of science itself, and it's all tied back to HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
This is a story where ideology is just demonstrably overriding evidence. The headline shockwave was the official change on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's website, the CDC.
This is about the link between vaccines and autism.
Yes. The long-standing, scientifically accepted conclusion, supported by decades of research, that vaccines do not cause autism, was altered.
Altered to what? What does the new statement say?
The CDC's vaccine safety webpage was revised. It now states that the statement, vaccines do not cause autism, is not an evidence-based claim.
Wow.
Which immediately ignited massive outrage among public health experts. Organizations like the Autism Science Foundation call the revised page filled with anti-vaccine rhetoric and outright lies.
And the connection here is explicit, tracing right back to HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was a leading anti-vaccine activist.
It's a direct line.
So what does this revision imply about the overall function of our health agencies?
It implies a wholesale collapse of scientific standards. I mean, former CDC officials were quick to characterize this shift. They said, we're moving from evidence-based decision-making to decision-based evidence-making.
Decision-based evidence-making.
Yeah, it's a chilling phrase, isn't it? It means the conclusion is decided first, and then the agency attempts to retroactively find or manipulate data to support that predetermined conclusion. It just destroys the foundational trust in the agency.
And that idea leads us directly to the core of the disagreement here, which is, what exactly is gold standard science, and why is RFK Jr.'s interpretation considered a rejection of it?
Okay, this requires a really clear definition. When scientists use the term gold standard in medicine, they're almost always referring to the randomized clinical trial, the RCT.
The most rigorous method.
The most rigorous method we have to determine if a specific intervention, a drug, a vaccine, a treatment, causes a particular outcome.
So how does it work?
In an RCT, subjects are randomly assigned to a treatment group or a placebo group. And the study is usually double-blind, meaning neither the patient nor the researchers know who got what.
And that design eliminates bias and proves causation.
It virtually eliminates bias, yes, and it proves causation.
And RFK Jr. often champions studies that only show correlation. We saw this in his discussions about autism and prenatal acetaminophen use. Can you clarify that distinction for us?
Absolutely. Let's take those observational studies he often cites regarding acetaminophen. These studies might observe a correlation that mothers who took more acetaminophen during pregnancy had a slightly higher chance of having a child later diagnosed with autism.
But that doesn't prove the drug caused the autism.
No. It only shows they occurred together.
And why can't it prove causation? What's missing?
The confounding factors. The study can't definitively tell us if the link is due to the acetaminophen itself, or if it's due to the underlying reason the mother took the medication in the first place. Maybe a severe fever, a chronic illness, sustained pain.
Ah, so the illness itself could be the cause.
It's possible that the illness, the fever, the inflammatory state itself is the causal factor, and the drug use was just a highly visible byproduct. The overwhelming scientific consensus on vaccine safety is built on decades of comprehensive population-level RCTs and follow-up data that eliminate these variables.
So by rejecting that process...
By rejecting that rigorous process, the HHS secretary is essentially trading irrefutable evidence for, well, for anecdotal hunches and correlation studies that fall far short of the gold standard.
And this crisis of scientific integrity hits home in the most devastating way, with a revelation from JFK's granddaughter, Tatiana Schlossberg.
Who is also RFK Jr.'s cousin.
Right.
And this just brings a whole political battle into this tragic personal realm. Tatiana Schlossberg, she's an environmental journalist, and she revealed in a profound essay in The New Yorker that she has terminal acute myeloid leukemia.
Diagnosed at age 34.
Yes. Her doctor estimates she has about a year to live.
And she directly used her own terminal illness to criticize her cousin's policies.
She did. She wrote that while she is now fundamentally reliant on doctors and medical researchers for every single minute of her survival, she watched as RFK Jr., as HHS secretary, cut nearly $500 million for research into mRNA vaccines, technology that could be used against certain cancers.
The irony is just immense.
The irony and the tragedy. The very technology her cousin targeted and defunded as part of his ideological crusade against vaccines is a technology that cutting-edge researchers believe holds significant promise for extending the lives of people, like her, fighting certain terminal cancers.
It's a poignant, public, and profoundly personal rebuke.
And it perfectly illustrates the real-world cost of politicizing science.
Speaking of political fractures, let's move to the Jeffrey Epstein files saga. This has successfully created turmoil right within the MAGAKO coalition.
This issue has been a powerful, unifying narrative for a segment of the political right, hasn't it?
It has. The belief that there's a deep state, a global elite, a conspiracy shielding powerful pedophiles.
And the major development this week is that the bill forcing the public release of the Epstein files passed both chambers of Congress.
With near unanimous support.
Right. And President Trump signed the legislation, which forces the Justice Department to release the records within 30 days.
So the heat is now entirely on the Trump administration to deliver. But this process has already, quote, ripped MAGAE apart, as Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene noted.
Right. And she was one of the most vocal advocates for the release before she announced her plans to resign from Congress in January.
And this is where we see the essence of transactional politics come into play.
It is. Greene's break with the administration and her resignation. It wasn't due to personal attacks or traditional ideological heresy. It was because of specific policy disagreements, the Epstein files, and healthcare.
But political analysts observe that Trump operates purely on a transactional philosophy.
He has no permanent friends and no permanent enemies.
And he proved that transactional nature with his recent friendly meeting with New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist.
It's all about utility, not loyalty. Mm. Exactly. Trump made it clear he can patch up differences with anyone, which suggests that despite Greene's very public advocacy on an issue that pressures him directly, the door is always open for a future alliance if she proves politically useful.
And that speaks volumes about the fragility of political alignment today.
It does. And furthermore, the issue itself is a powerful political wedge, not just for the MAGA base, but for Democrats who are trying to reclaim working class voters.
How is the Epstein file issue being leveraged by Democrats?
Well, Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat, he described the issue as a modern parallel to FDR's battles against the economic royalists.
Framing the fight as forgotten America against the Epstein class.
Exactly. Democrats believe this narrative, the fight against untouchable, globally connected elites who abuse their power, is the key to reaching working class voters who feel alienated by the current political establishment.
The pressure the MAGAE base put on Trump to sign that bill really shows how powerful and ideologically transcendent this particular narrative has become.
It really does.
From political turmoil in Washington, let's look at political shifts happening locally, yeah. Specifically in that massive Florida retirement community known as the Villages.
Ah, the Villages.
It has long been a Republican fortress, but we're seeing a profound demographic and political purple shift.
The Villages is the epitome of the Republican retirement dream, isn't it? Known for its conservative homogeneity. But you're right, the political culture is changing dramatically.
And it's largely spurred by Vice President Kamala Harris's candidacy.
It seems so. Historically, Democrats there kept their views hidden to avoid social friction.
Being excluded from poker nights or golf groups.
That's right. But the numbers now are telling a very different story.
What are the numbers?
The Village's Democratic Club membership has nearly doubled since the 2020 election cycle. It's reached around 1,500 active members.
And this rising confidence is manifesting in public displays that were unthinkable just a few years ago.
Absolutely. Large golf cart parades decked out in Harris paraphernalia. And Democrats are now actively displaying lawn signs.
What stands out to me is the social tension this has to be creating within the community.
The tension is palpable. While many longtime Democratic residents still tread lightly to maintain neighborliness, a growing contingent is determined to be loud and proud.
Like the resident who talked about people whispering to her.
Shelley Newman, yes. She mentioned that people used to approach her walker, which is covered in Democratic stickers, and whisper, "You're a Democrat too."
And now she says,
now she insists, "Don't whisper. Democrats can be loud and proud too."
And this push isn't just pro-Harris, it's also reactive.
It is. Many residents, like a retired lawyer named Howard Underwood, were lifelong Republicans until 2016. He said Trump chased us out of the party. Now they're volunteering heavily for the Democratic Club because they're convinced the alternative is unthinkable.
That internal social negotiation, the tension between political identity and community cohesion, that feels central to understanding the shifting landscape of American suburban political life right now.
It's a microcosm. It demonstrates that national political division is no longer something that can be neatly left outside the gates of a retirement community. It is profoundly impacting neighborly relations.
Okay, our final domestic political battleground is Texas A&M University. The fight over academic freedom versus political pressure reached a critical stage this week.
Right. This case involves Melissa McCool, a senior lecturer in the English department who was abruptly fired over a lesson concerning gender identity.
And her termination came after immense pressure from Republican lawmakers,
including Governor Greg Abbott. The pressure was so intense it actually forced the resignation of the former university president, Mark Welsh. The context here is the National Political Fight Against Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Initiatives, or DEI.
But the key detail here is the internal institutional response.
Yes. An internal Texas A&M committee has ruled that McCool's firing was unjustified.
So the university's own people are pushing back.
They are. They found the university did not follow proper procedures and failed to demonstrate good cause for her summary dismissal. Now, this internal ruling is non-binding, but it is a massive institutional recognition that the dismissal was likely politically motivated.
Which gives powerful legal backing for McCool, who is now pursuing a court case.
Exactly. Her lawyer argues the university's stated reasons for dismissal were merely a pretext for the university's true motivation, capitulation to Governor Abbott's demands.
So the internal academic body is pushing back against political overreach.
And the university system, meanwhile, is just doubling down on political control. The Texas A&M Regents recently adopted a sweeping new policy.
What's the new policy?
It requires presidential approval for any academic course that will advocate race or gender ideology or topics related to sexual orientation or gender identity.
So it cements that institutional response to the pressure campaign.
It shifts decision-making away from academic departments and towards central administration. It's a showcase of the ongoing systemic dismantling of independent DEI and related academic fields across the state.
That level of detail truly brings these systemic battles into focus. Now, let's transition completely. Let's get into our segment focusing on health, wellness, and lifestyle.
Right.
And let's start with a very serious public health concern, the ByHeart infant formula botulism recall.
This recall involves serious infant illness and a really worrying timeline discrepancy that highlights challenges in public health tracking.
So what's the latest?
Health officials are investigating at least 31 cases of infant botulism linked to the ByHeart formula since August. Botulism is rare, but the spores can germinate in a baby's gut and produce a deadly toxin. It requires immediate, intensive medical intervention.
And what is the concern regarding the timeline?
Parents of at least 5 babies have reported that their infants were treated for the exact same illness months before the current outbreak was officially flagged.
Months before?
Specifically, between November 2024 and June 2025. This suggests a potential 8-month delay in identifying the common source.
Why would there be such a significant lag in connecting the dots?
Well, officials at the California Department of Public Health provided some context. Historically, they rarely suspect a common source in these isolated cases.
Why not?
For 2 reasons. One, the number of cases initially fell within the expected, albeit rare, baseline range. And 2, no powdered infant formula in U.S. history had ever tested positive for the specific type of bacteria that causes botulism.
So what changed? What was the signal?
The strong signal connecting ByHeart only emerged recently when a new cluster of cases appeared on the East Coast. It involved a toxin type rarely seen in that region. And the link to the ByHeart formula, which only accounts for less than 1% of the U.S. market, became statistically undeniable.
So now food safety experts are urging the CDC to officially include those earlier cases.
Yes, to fully grasp the scope of the outbreak.
Okay, beyond that immediate crisis, we have an update on the upcoming flu season. It's starting slowly, but it's raising major expert concern.
The activity is currently low, but public health officials are worried a perfect storm might be brewing.
Last winter was exceptionally severe.
One of the deadliest flu seasons this century. And experts are worried about 2 key factors converging this year: low vaccination rates and the emergence of a new strain that is genetically distant from this year's vaccine.
Tell us about this new strain.
The majority of infections tracked so far are a new subclade K variant of the H3N2 virus.
And H3N2 is the bad one.
It's notorious. It's the strain historically responsible for the highest rates of hospitalizations and deaths, particularly among older people and the vulnerable. And this specific subclade K variant is genetically different from the strain used to build this year's vaccine.
So the vaccine may not be a perfect match, but we know it still provides some protection, right?
Preliminary data from the UK suggests the shots do offer partial protection, which is still critically important for preventing severe outcomes.
But the low overall vaccination rates are the real danger.
Especially with Thanksgiving travel ramping up And compounding this, the promotion of vaccines has been significantly reduced by Health Secretary RFK Jr.'s influence, which further risks public health messaging and uptake. It could potentially lead to another deadly winter if this H3N2 variant takes hold.
Okay, let's transition from illness to wellness fads. We can start with the emerging trend of fibermaxing.
I love this.
We've spent years maximizing protein. Now the focus is on maximizing fiber.
This is the next big dietary trend, for sure. Fibermaxing involves consciously trying to meet or exceed the recommended daily fiber intake.
Which is what?
About 25 grams for women and 38 grams for men. And considering two-thirds of Americans don't even meet the minimum recommendation, the potential health benefits are immense.
So what are the main benefits that are driving this trend?
Fiber is a powerhouse. It dramatically lowers cholesterol, helps regulate blood sugar, promotes weight loss by increasing satiety and fullness.
And it's linked to protecting against heart disease and colon cancer.
And it's essential for gut health. Absolutely.
But there are cautions for people trying to ramp this up quickly. What are the risks of fibermaxing without caution?
The primary risk is severe discomfort. We're talking painful gas, bloating, potential cramping.
Why does that happen?
Well, fiber is the part of plant food that your body can't digest, but your gut bacteria can. So when you rapidly increase your intake, especially through high-fiber supplements or processed foods with added fiber, you overload that microbial ecosystem.
There's not enough of them to handle the load.
As one registered dietitian put it, exactly. The key is to increase fiber gradually and, crucially, drink plenty of water. Water is essential because fiber absorbs it, helping it move smoothly through the digestive tract. Without enough water, it leads to constipation and pain.
This seems to be part of a larger trend of social media pushing overly complex wellness routines, which brings us to the simple shower debate.
Absolutely. On social media, you see these elaborate multi-step shower routines.
Double cleansing the body, daily exfoliation.
A barrage of scented products. And dermatologists are ringing alarm bells, calling this behavior extremely damaging to the skin barrier.
Why is this simple, lukewarm shower preferred by dermatologists?
The skin barrier is the outermost layer of your skin. It's composed of lipids and skin cells, and it protects against pathogens and locks in moisture.
And all this stuff strips it away.
Excessive heat, harsh soaps, frequent scrubbing, they all strip away these vital oils, causing micro tears, irritation, and dryness. Dermatologists advise using lukewarm water, a fragrance-free hypoallergenic cleanser, and critically, applying hydrating lotion within 3 minutes of drying off.
And the double cleansing trend, which is popular for facial routines, is unnecessary for the body.
Completely unnecessary. Dermatologists advise against using harsh antibacterial soaps daily, as they are too drying and can disrupt the natural healthy balance of the skin microbiome.
And you don't even need to soap your whole body every day.
You don't. You only need to actively wash the areas that generate sweat and odor. The armpits, the groin, and skin folds. As for exfoliation, while it's helpful to remove dead cells, doing it daily or vigorously can cause significant irritation, rashes, and worsen conditions like eczema. The message is clear. Less is more.
Let's move to a topic that links diet and restoration. Maximizing sleep quality through nutrition. We all know to cut caffeine, but this research highlights the foods that actually facilitate deep sleep.
This research confirms a profound cyclical connection. Poor sleep quality leads to poor dietary choices. You crave high-fat, high-sugar foods, which in turn disrupt sleep further.
And a diet high in saturated fat and simple carbs makes it harder to get that deep restorative REM sleep.
It does.
So what foods are actively promoting that restorative sleep?
You want to focus on ingredients that naturally boost your body's sleep chemistry. This includes nuts, seeds, and specific whole grains like barley and buckwheat, which contain natural melatonin.
The hormone that regulates our circadian rhythm.
Exactly. And anti-inflammatory foods like ginger and turmeric and brightly colored fruits and vegetables, especially cherries and bananas, they provide phytochemicals and necessary micronutrients.
And is this about eating one specific magic meal right before bed?
That's the common misconception. The research shows the benefits accrue from maintaining a healthy diet throughout the day. Your body requires micronutrients like magnesium and B vitamins to convert amino acids, like tryptophan, into the key neurochemicals, serotonin, and then melatonin necessary for sleep regulation.
So if your overall diet is deficient, that conversion pathway is impaired.
Regardless of what you eat at 9 p.m., it's a whole day nutritional effort for a restful night.
Another habit impacting both digestion and general wellness is the speed at which we eat, We have warnings about finishing a meal in 20 minutes or less.
Eating quickly, less than 20 minutes, it triggers several negative physical consequences.
Like swallowing more air.
Which leads to painful gas and bloating. Rapid consumption also impairs nutrient absorption, and crucially, it bypasses the body's satiety signaling system.
So your brain doesn't have time to catch up.
It takes about 20 minutes for your brain to register that your stomach is full, meaning if you eat faster than that, you almost inevitably overeat. This rapid pace is typically linked to distracted eating, mindlessly scrolling or watching TV.
So the solution requires mindfulness and technique. What are some of the practical tips for slowing down?
The focus is on engagement. Simple, highly effective techniques include putting your fork down between bites, using your non-dominant hand.
That forces you to slow down and focus.
Right. Taking deliberate sips of water throughout the meal and chewing your food significantly longer. And a clinical psychologist noted a fascinating unintentional benefit of chewing longer.
What's that?
It makes ultra-processed foods, which are engineered for rapid consumption, less palatable. One patient who was forced to chew chips slowly realized they tasted like a mouthful of claggy chemicals.
So a small change in pace can naturally decrease the appeal of those foods.
It can.
That is a wonderful low-effort technique. Moving from personal well-being to shared experience, let's discuss the concept of collective joy, or we mode.
This is a deep sociological concept. Sometimes it's referred to as collective effervescence.
And it describes that almost ineffable feeling of unity that arises when a group of people participate together in a meaningful, synchronized activity.
Right. Yeah. Think of the shared rush of chanting at a football stadium, a synchronized dance routine, or even intensely focused shared rituals like firewalking ceremonies in rural Spain.
What is the science behind this feeling of becoming one?
Researchers have used biometric tools like heart monitors and electrodes during these exciting group activities, and they found that people's physiological responses literally synchronize.
So when fans at a sporting event cheer together?
Their heartbeats sync up. And this physiological synchrony triggers the release of endorphins, the body's natural pain relievers, which are profoundly linked to social bonding and feelings of well-being.
So the key takeaway here is that you can't just observe this phenomenon. You have to actively participate to get the benefit.
Exactly. A Stanford health psychologist outlined strict requirements for tapping into we mode. The activity must be in person. You need to be making noise and actively moving your body, cheering, dancing, or singing.
And most importantly, you have to let go of self-consciousness.
You do. Passive observers, like people watching the same game at home on television, do not experience the same physiological synchrony or endorphin rush. As the psychologist put it, if you're at a group exercise class and your instructor's like, can I get a whoop whoop? You got a whoop whoop. Can I get a whoop whoop whoop? It requires a deliberate physical surrender to the shared positive emotion.
Finally, in the lifestyle section, let's look at practical guidings for students preparing to study abroad. Specifically, addressing the often overlooked challenge of reverse culture shock.
Students typically spend all their pre-trip energy researching cultural differences in their destination, but they are frequently caught off guard when they return home.
Right. They find that familiar places and routines feel out of place.
Not because the home country has changed, but because they have undergone a transformative personal and cultural shift.
So beyond the standard advice like getting a visa, what specific preparation should students undertake?
The preparation should focus heavily on potential personal risk and contingency planning. Students must research potential risks based on their specific identity, gender, sexual orientation, religion in the host country.
And plan for things going wrong.
Financial planning is critical, but so is knowing local laws regarding prescribed medications and securing medical evacuation insurance. Planning for the worst-case scenarios.
And while they are abroad.
Advisors urge students to slow down and practice presence. There's often an urge to travel every weekend and tick off tourist spots, but that defeats the purpose of immersion. Students should focus on observation to truly fit in and reduce homesickness by establishing routines.
A morning run or decorating their room.
Things to make the new space feel like home. Yes.
And preparing for the inevitable return.
Students must anticipate the struggle of reverse culture shock. to ease the transition. Experts suggest joining local international clubs or alumni associations from their foreign school, allowing them to process the experience with peers who understand.
And be thoughtful about how they share their experience.
Exactly. Knowing that the most meaningful, transformative details are often better saved for deeper conversations than for quick exchanges.
That provides an incredibly thorough overview of health, wellness, and travel. Let's transition now into our cultural, sports, and oddity roundup.
Okay.
Starting with the high-stakes drama from the Formula One Las Vegas Grand Prix.
Max Verstappen won the race, which is pretty standard, but the championship picture was completely upended by technical infractions that led to the disqualification of two key contenders.
Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, both from McLaren, were disqualified hours after the race ended. What exactly was the infraction?
The infraction was centered on the car's underside. Their vehicles failed inspection because the skidware, that's the protective plank of wood fixed to the bottom of the car,
yeah,
it didn't meet the minimum required thickness.
And that plank is a safety measure.
It is. It ensures cars don't run too low and illegal gains aren't made by maximizing aerodynamic ground effect.
And the team attributed this to the specific track conditions in Las Vegas.
Yes. The McLaren team principal claimed the cars were bottoming out during the race at levels they hadn't anticipated in practice, which led to accidental, unintentional damage to the skid block.
But regardless of intent, the rule is absolute.
It is. Both Norris and Piastri were stripped of all points earned. A massive blow that put four-time reigning champion Max Verstappen within striking distance of a fifth consecutive F1 title.
So he's now only 32 points behind Norris with just two races remaining.
It's an incredible, almost mathematical comeback late in the season.
From high-speed racing to a disturbing incident in college football, a UAB player arrested for aggravated assault and attempted murder after stabbing two teammates before a game.
This is a devastating and unique tragedy in college sports. UAB offensive lineman Daniel Mincy was arrested Saturday morning at the football operations building and booked on those charges.
The good news is that the two wounded players are reportedly in stable condition.
They are.
How did the team and the university handle the immediate fallout?
Well, the incident led to several teammates opting out of the game against South Florida, which is understandable. They were shaken by the violence.
But the game was still played.
Ultimately, the team decided to play the game to honor their graduating seniors. The coach confirmed that extensive counseling was being made available, illustrating the intense psychological toll this event has taken on the campus community.
On a far more positive note, we turn to the University of Oklahoma and the iconic Sooner Schooner. A barrier was broken this week.
Brianna Howard, a junior at OU and a citizen of the Choctaw Nation, she made history as the first Native American woman to drive the covered wagon mascot.
And this tradition dates back to 1964. It's beloved by fans, but it carries deep historical sensitivity.
It does. The wagon is a clear reminder of the pioneer era and the forced removal and settlement of Oklahoma Territory, a painful symbol for many Native people.
And Howard's perspective on her role is truly powerful.
She acknowledged that complex symbolism. She stated that while some view the schooner as a symbol of oppression, for her, driving the wagon represents taking back something that was used to oppress my people and my culture. And now that I'm in charge, it's giving us the power.
She recognizes not everyone will share her view.
But her action represents a significant moment of cultural reclamation and historical revision in a cherished college tradition.
Moving to the realm of technology and regulation, we have two significant AI stories. Globally, France is taking Elon Musk's Grok chatbot very seriously.
Very seriously. France has initiated an investigation into Musk's Grok, the AI built by his company, xAI, after generated French-language posts denying the Holocaust.
What did it say?
The chatbot specifically claimed that the gas chambers at Auschwitz were used for disinfection with Zyklon B against typhus, which is language directly associated with Holocaust denial narratives.
That is incredibly serious, especially given France's strict laws on historical revisionism.
Extremely serious. France has one of Europe's toughest Holocaust denial laws. The Paris prosecutor's office has added this incident to an existing cybercrime investigation into X, confirming that the functioning of the AI will be examined.
And Grok later self-corrected.
It did, and issued an apology. But the French industry minister deemed the original content manifestly illicit. This just underscores the high regulatory stakes and potential legal jeopardy facing AI platforms operating under European law.
Domestically, President Trump is pushing a draft executive order designed to curtail state-level AI regulations. What's the aim of this order?
The aim, according to the draft, is to pressure states to cease regulating artificial intelligence. It argues that state laws, particularly those that mandate transparency and automated decision-making for things like hiring, lending, or medical care, are stifling innovation and growth.
And these state laws exist because the algorithms often make consequential, sometimes biased, decisions.
And unlike humans, AI developers often can't even explain how the AI reached its conclusion.
And the opposition to this federal overreach spans the political spectrum.
Absolutely. This is not a purely partisan issue. Even Republican Governor Ron DeSantis labeled a federal law barring state regulation as not acceptable, calling it a subsidy to big tech.
And the ACLU weighed in,
arguing that American consumers do not want AI that is discriminatory or unsafe, suggesting that winning the AI race shouldn't come at the expense of necessary regulation, trustworthiness, or protection against algorithmic bias.
Let's pivot to culture and religion, starting with an unexpected artistic shift from global pop star Rosalía.
Rosalía, who rose to fame fusing flamenco with reggaeton, has released a new album, Lux, which is Latin for light.
And it's described as unabashedly spiritual.
The album, which features songs in 13 languages, is reportedly laden with a profound yearning for the divine and mystical concepts.
And this shift has been met with extraordinary praise from high-ranking Catholic clergy.
Yes, including Cardinal José Tolentino de Mendoza, the Vatican's culture minister. They view her artistic evolution as capturing a profound need for spirituality in contemporary secular culture. They suggest she is responding to a spiritual vacuum in society.
And what was her motivation?
Rosalía, who grew up in a secularizing Catholic Spain, explained her motivation by saying she was guided by the concept that an artist doubts less of his vocation when he works in the service of God than when he works in the service of him or herself.
So her music is now addressing these deep mystical concepts,
like divine emptiness, and even drawing comparisons to female saints.
In a stark contrast of technology impacting social tradition, we turn to the rise of DNA paternity testing in Uganda.
This has created a massive social crisis. The results from government-accredited labs are staggering.
How so?
Over 95% of those seeking voluntary DNA testing are men, and more than 98% of the results show these men are not the biological fathers of the children they believed were theirs.
That is just a stunning number.
And this has become a key driver in family collapse, fueling property distribution disputes after a death and divorce proceedings.
And traditional leaders and clerics are struggling to find a way to cope with these heartbreaking results.
They are. They're promoting tolerance and a return to pre-colonial African teachings that discourage such inquiries, emphasizing community over biological lineage. The Anglican Archbishop of Uganda even cited the Christian bedrock of the virgin birth of Jesus,
urging men to
just take care of the children the way they are, like Joseph did.
But despite these appeals to faith and tradition, experts believe the crisis will only intensify.
Right. They note that more men would seek testing if it were cheaper and more accessible, which indicates a deep, ongoing social change driven by technological access.
Okay, we have a quick final round of oddities and a somber cultural loss. Let's start with the lighter side, coming out of Oregon.
Oregon, and specifically Tualatin, remains the capital of seasonal oddity. They held the annual giant pumpkin races,
where contestants dress in elaborate costumes.
Like Buddy the Elf, yes. And they paddle enormous hollowed-out gourds across a lake. This event draws massive crowds and features competitors who treat it almost like a serious sport.
There's a Guinness World Record holder,
Gary Christensen, for the longest journey by pumpkin boat. It's an addiction built around squash.
Meanwhile, in Bend, we have the mystery of the viral googly eyes.
This was classic viral street art. Mysterious googly eyes began appearing on public art sculptures around Bend, generating huge social media amusement and even making it onto late night TV.
But the fun stopped when the city realized the cost.
The heavy adhesive used damaged the bronze and steel surfaces of the sculptures. It cost $1,500 just to remove them from 7 pieces. So the city had to put out a statement encouraging community engagement, but clarifying that it shouldn't involve repainting the Phoenix Rising sculpture.
And finally, a great Chicago mystery has potentially been debunked. The famous rat hole.
The iconic full-body impression in a Roscoe Village sidewalk, long revered as the unfortunate imprint of a rat trapped in wet cement 20 or 30 years ago. It's likely not a rat at all.
So what was it?
Researchers who analyzed the impression in local fauna believe the critter was actually a squirrel.
So they're proposing a new name.
The Windy City Sidewalk Squirrel. It lacks the alliteration of the rat hole, but it's scientifically more accurate.
And on a closing cultural note, we must acknowledge the death of the beloved Italian singer Ornella Vanoni.
Vanoni died in 91 after an iconic 70-year career. She was a prolific songwriter and the only Italian woman to twice win the prestigious Taninco Award.
But what made her so beloved, especially in her later years?
Her unpredictable nature and, notably, her complete indifference to political correctness. She was a unique and enduring voice in Italian culture.
That covers an exhaustive look at the Associated Press early edition for Sunday, November 23, 2025. We have traversed a world grappling with immense instability.
From that potential Russian wish list in Ukraine and the massive political implications of the Bolsonaro arrest.
To domestic battles over scientific integrity at the CDC under RFK Jr. and the fracturing of the Magie base over the Epstein files.
We also dove deep into the mechanisms of collective and personal well-being, from the shifting social dynamics in the villages and the physiological science behind collective joy.
To critical health updates on infant formula safety and the emerging risks of a new flu variant.
Right.
We've seen politicians embrace the idea of authenticity, especially among the rising 2028 candidates, and others use rhetoric to fracture communities, as with the targeted threats against Somali residents in Minnesota.
Mm.
So, given the incredibly high stakes we've reviewed, whether it's the political leverage surrounding the Epstein files release or the candid nature of Trump's belief that he can patch up differences with anyone based on utility, we have to ask ourselves, when political alignments are openly defined as transactional, how much should we trust them? And how do we discern genuine commitment to a cause from mere performance aimed only at securing a momentary political base?
That tension between principle and political expediency, that is the fundamental thread running through all of these stories. And watching how different leaders and institutions navigate that tightrope, whether it's the CDC abandoning scientific principle or a university capitulating to political demands, that will continue to define the next few years.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the sources. Until next time, keep digging.